Okay, let me just refresh your memory quickly as to where we were on Wednesday when we stopped, and then we'll proceed. We were working our way through this diagram. Let me see if I can make the contrast just a bit better for you. Can't do it. I think that's it. We were working our way through how's that? Ah, hola. Working our way through this diagram, this is the generic gram-positive bacteria. Cell wall, we looked at drugs that use the cell wall as a target, primarily beta-lactams, but others that we looked at. We briefly stopped and looked at one drug, polymyxin B, that worked at the level of the bacterial cell membrane. And now we're going to move into the cytoplasm, and we did that on Wednesday. We introduced drugs that affect bacterial protein synthesis, and we looked specifically at the machinery, that is, how do bacteria synthesize protein, and how is that different than the way mammalian cells synthesize protein. And now we're going to drill down and look at the drugs that work and how they affect protein synthesis of bacteria, the mechanisms for resistance, how they are used clinically, and then lastly, we're going to be concerned with what are the side effects that these drugs exhibit. And the place we're going to begin is with a class of drugs called tetracyclines. There's not any logic here in terms of priority. There are many drugs that affect the bacteria's ability to synthesize protein. Tetracyclines, just a class of drugs that fit this bill, and that's where we will begin. And this is the structure of a typical tetracycline drug. All of these are made by bugs and modified by chemists. So all of these are either totally natural or semi-synthetic derivatives, and they all vary in terms of substitutions at position 5, 6, and 7. And what you need to remember is this is a four-membered ring where, or the basis for its naming, tetracycline. And this ring system, as we'll see, imparts a couple properties to these molecules. One of the properties is tetracyclines fluoresce. So if you put a tetracycline in solution, you activate it with UV light, it will emit or fluoresce at a longer wavelength. And the other characteristic that falls out of this ring system is these compounds have an affinity for divalent metal ions. They are chelators. And the different tetracyclines, as I indicated, are the result of differing substitutions here. There are really two or three of these that are predominantly used. And what we will see as we talk through the pharmacology is, for all practical purposes, a tetracycline is a tetracycline is a tetracycline. They're going to differ in their pharmacokinetic properties. They're going to differ in their half-lives. They're going to differ in the primary route of excretion. But at a given therapeutic level, all function in the same way. And the most commonly used of these are doxycycline and minocycline. These are the two because they have the longest half-lives. It is easier to achieve compliance in a patient with these compounds because they can be taken once a day. And doxycycline, let me mention it now and I will mention it again, is a compound that is primarily excreted in the bile. And thus it becomes an effective drug in use in patients that have decreased kidney function. Well, how do they work? What's the mechanism of action of tetracyclines? And then specifically, what is their basis for their selective toxicity? In order for these drugs to work, they must be actively accumulated by the bacteria. Bacteria have an active uptake mechanism at the level of the cell membrane that accumulates these drugs. So one way that the drug gets in is active uptake. Some of the newer drugs, doxycycline, minocycline as examples, are lipid soluble, and diffusion is also a means of entry. So the drug is taken up actively in susceptible bacteria or diffuses in and then inhibits bacterial protein synthesis. And it does so in the following way. The drug binds to the 30S ribosomal subunit. It binds to the 30S ribosomal subunit at this A site. So this is the binding site for the tetracyclines. The tetracyclines bind and they block this step. They block the entry of the amino acyl transfer RNA into that A site. They inhibit protein synthesis at this stage. Now, if you have bugs and you expose the bug to tetracycline, what you would see is the tetracycline would inhibit the ability of the bacteria to divide, to multiply. If you remove the drug, or in the patient, as the blood level drops, protein synthesis resumes and the ability of the organism to carry out division returns. These are bacteriostatic antibiotics. Now, what about resistance? How do bacteria develop resistance to tetracycline? It really comes in two major ways. One is bacteria alter the active uptake process such that the drug no longer is accumulated in sufficient amounts to inhibit protein synthesis. This clearly is a mechanism for gram-positive bacteria. It is also a mechanism observed in gram-negative bacteria, but gram-negative bacteria have one other component to the mechanism, and that is, in gram-negative bacteria, resistance is both decreased accumulation, decreased active uptake, coupled with the active efflux, the active removal of the drug from the cytoplasm out of the bacteria. Gram-negative bacteria have active efflux pumps that pump the drug out of the cytoplasm, decreasing the concentration further, such that protein synthesis is not inhibited. This can be induced by tetracyclines. It is plasma mediated, and it's at the level of the membrane, the plasma membrane of the bacteria. These two mechanisms have resulted in most bacteria being resistant to tetracyclines. Now, if we talk about the pharmacology of the tetracyclines, and as I indicated, there's little difference in these drugs from a therapeutic point of view. The difference is pharmacokinetic. All of the tetracyclines, and we're going to stay generic here, all of the tetracyclines are adequately but incompletely absorbed when they are taken orally. All tetracyclines are adequately but incompletely absorbed. That is, not all of the drug is going to be absorbed from the intestine. Thus, active drug is going to move down the GI tract, and we're going to see there are issues associated with that. Some, such as doxycycline, that are more lipid-soluble are more highly absorbed versus drugs like tetracycline itself. The absorption of the drug is impaired by the presence of divalent and trivalent metal ions. So, in the presence of dairy products rich in calcium, in the presence of antacids that have magnesium and iron and aluminum, one gets the formation of chelates, and these chelates are not absorbed. And so the admonition or the advice that one does not consume these drugs in the presence of divalent and trivalent metal ions, in the presence of dairy products, in the presence of antacids. Once the drug is absorbed, it distributes to tissues, localizing in tissues. Tetracyclines localize in the liver and in a variety of tissues. Most of the drugs are not able to cross the blood-brain barrier, therefore have no effective antibacterial activity in the central nervous system. So they are capable of entering tissues, of entering various peripheral fluids, and bringing about an antibacterial response. They are concentrated in the liver. And in the liver, tetracyclines are both metabolized, and metabolism here is primarily conjugation. Tetracyclines are conjugated in the liver, and then the conjugated molecule is passed into the bile and can be cleaved and the drug reabsorbed, and so all of these, to varying degrees, undergo enterohepatic circulation. Some of the tetracyclines, I'll use doxycycline as an example. Doxycycline is primarily then excreted in the feces. In contrast to, and again I'll use tetracycline, which is the generic parent compound, which is predominantly eliminated by the kidneys. So there is the possibility within this class to select a drug depending on the status of the patient that has biliary versus renal elimination as the primary route. Now, if we look at how these drugs are used clinically. I said that tetracyclines, or if I didn't, let me just clarify for you. Tetracyclines are a classic example of broad-spectrum antibiotics. These drugs affect gram-positive, gram-negative, a variety of atypical microorganisms. In fact, they even have activity against protozoal organisms. When we get to malaria, you're going to see that doxycycline can be used in anti-malaria prophylaxis. So they have an enormous spectrum of activity, but clinically, their use has been narrowed, decreased because of resistance. So here's how tetracyclines are used. They're used against sort of the atypicals. They're effective in the treatment of chlamydia, Chlamydia trachomatis, sexually transmitted chlamydia is a very prevalent disease. Tetracyclines and doxycyclines specifically provide an effective means of treatment. Rocky Mountain spotted fever, another intracellular organism transmitted by or through the organism Rickettsia rickettsii, is susceptible to treatment with tetracyclines. As is cholera, not so much curative, but rather in combination with fluid replacement to decrease the intestinal content or the intestinal numbers of the organism, the vibro organism. It's useful in the treatment. Tetracyclines are, again, I use doxycycline because of its pharmacokinetics, which make patient compliance better. Doxycycline can be used to treat Lyme disease, a tick transferred organism called Borrelia. And it can be used to treat atypical pneumonia, pneumonia caused by Mycoplasma pneumoniae. You see it typically in school children, in dormitories, in people that are under or housed in confined conditions, jails, prisons, etc. And tetracyclines become a means of treatment. Now, there's one other use for tetracyclines, and I want to mention it, and then we'll move to what are the liabilities, what are the side effects that you see with tetracyclines. So what you see here is, here is a broad spectrum or a class of antibiotics that are broad in spectrum, but their clinical perspective is really, if you like, atypicals. Not the all-American gram-positive or the all-American gram-negative organism. And that's because of resistance. Now, there's one other use for tetracyclines. And this is somewhat atypical. And this is a dermatological use. You don't have this in your handout, but you know this from your anatomy. And that is, in the management of acne, tetracyclines have significant utility, minocycline being the one that most commonly is used, because minocycline tends to be concentrated in skin. So, let me just orient you, and this is a short course on acne. I'm going to share everything that I know, which is not much. As you know, acne is an inflammatory disease. It's an inflammatory response. And it involves the sebaceous gland that is associated with hair follicles. And this sebaceous gland produces oils that are known as sebum. And this, the oils have a number of functions. One of the functions of the oils is to keep the hair fiber flexible and shiny. The other is to protect or diminish the amount of loss of water by evaporation through the epidermis. And so the sebaceous glands associated with this hair follicle really provide oil of Olay to the skin. Now, in acne, this is a process that goes a bit haywire. So let me just talk you through this if this is not familiar to you. Whoa, sorry. In acne, what you have is you have, and as you know, acne particularly is a problem when hormones kick in, specifically at puberty, and more specifically with increased circulating amounts of androgen. And the increased circulating amounts of androgen turn on the sebaceous glands, and the sebaceous glands start producing more sebum. You know that from experience. Your skin at puberty became more oily, and you had more problems with skin blemishes. So under the influence of androgen, sebum production increases. And there are microflora that inhabit the skin, one being Propionibacterium acnes, that use this sebum as fuel, that catabolize, that metabolize the sebum. So now the bug has endless supply of food. For lack of a better, pigs out. And so the increased sebum allows for increased numbers of Propionibacterium acnes. The androgen also stimulates follicular epithelial cells to proliferate. And this can lead to clogging of the sebaceous gland. Now, with increased number of Propionibacterium acnes, the result of increased availability of sebum, the bug metabolizes the sebum, and the product of that metabolism is the production of free fatty acids. The bug takes triglycerides and generates free fatty acids. So the amount of free fatty acid increases, and the free fatty acid is an irritant, damages the skin. And the injury to the skin sets off signals that lead to ultimately an inflammatory reaction. Tetracyclines are used to suppress the symptoms of acne. Yeah. I don't know. Because sebaceous glands are found, it's not totally the case. Many people have it on the back, many people have it on the chest, and you just don't see it, okay? But why do you not see acne on the calves? I know not, okay? There may be other factors that are involved that I'm not aware of. So, tetracyclines, minocycline being one example thereof, can be used to impair or inhibit the replication as well as the metabolism of Propionibacterium acnes, and in the process decrease the production of inflammatory substances. How it works most likely is by inhibiting protein synthesis. There's good evidence that at the doses that are used to manage acne, the antibiotic is not reducing the number of microflora on the skin. So one might envision that what's happening is the antibiotic is simply impairing the microorganism such that its ability to metabolize sebum is reduced. And thus, the production of free fatty acids. And over time, the inflammatory stimulus is decreased or reduced and the lesions heal. Now, I've indicated here, this is suppressive therapy. It's not curative. And as you know, organisms over time can become resistant to the drug that the dermatologist has selected. And so it's necessary to shift to other drugs, and there are other drugs that can be used to treat. Now, when acne is treated with a tetracycline, the tetracycline is taken orally. So the obvious question would be, in contrast to other drugs that can be used topically, why is it that tetracyclines have not been used successfully in a topical management of acne? And the answer is, there was an attempt to do this. There was a preparation called topocycline that was produced and marketed, but if you think about it, here's the problem. The teeny bopper takes and puts the topocycline on the skin, okay, maybe on the wazoo, on the back, on the chest, places you can't even see the acne, okay? and then goes to a dance, and the dance has black light. She or he fluoresces, and that's the end of topocycline. Okay, it was socially unacceptable to the target group. And so when acne is managed with tetracyclines, the tetracyclines are taken orally. They tend to be given at doses that are lower than used to treat bacterial infection, because you're treating these individuals now for weeks and months. There are other drugs that can be given topically. One we will visit on Wednesday called clindamycin or cleacin is used topically. There are various substances that are used topically. But tetracyclines represent one use for chronic antibiotic use and a good example of suppression without cure. But if indeed you can suppress, the lesions resolve, and the patient is happy, the dermatologist looks good. So, those are the clinical uses for tetracyclines. Now the question becomes, what are the side effects that these drugs exhibit? In other words, what are the liabilities associated? Yeah, I'm sorry. Oh, bless you. I could be blessed too. What are the liabilities associated with tetracyclines? What are the adverse effects? And here are a few. One of the problems comes about as a result of incomplete absorption of tetracyclines. They toot down the GI tract, can irritate the stomach, irritate the small intestine, and can alter the microflora. So they can be irritative, so they can lead to nausea. They can alter the microflora, which in mild form can lead to diarrhea. They can, in more profound way, alter the microflora that leads to a superinfection. And so a superinfection or a replacement infection involving maybe Candida albicans, a vaginal yeast infection in a woman, frequently seen with tetracycline use. Now I said one of the characteristics of this molecule was that it had affinity for, bound to, divalent metal ions. It also has affinity for and binds to calcifying tissue. And in calcifying tissue, the form of the calcium is calcium orthophosphate. And calcium orthophosphate is the form of calcium in bone. It's also the form of the calcium in teeth, the enamel of the teeth. And so when tetracyclines are given to children, okay, I'm going to tell you they're contraindicated in children younger than 8 to 10 years of age. But when they are given to children, there is the potential for the drug to form a chelate with bone matrix and alter the developing bone or the formation of that bone, and to also bind to the enamel of the teeth and cause changes in the enamel of the teeth, hypoplasia of the enamel. And what happens is the drug binds to the enamel, I'm going to talk and point at the same time, the binds to the enamel of the teeth, and in a patient that has been treated with tetracyclines, you will see bands of fluorescence, which is representative of the drug calcium orthophosphate complex. You can detect this early on by shining UV light. You can see it readily later on because the complex breaks down. And that breakdown complex causes discoloration, cosmetic discoloration of the teeth. And invariably, there's someone in a class, perhaps not you, you're too young, but in older classes, that has been had tetracyclines as a child and has had altered enamel formation, increased tendency towards dental cavities or dental caries, and this is a cosmetic problem, but it also weakens the enamel of the teeth. It is a function of amount of drug, not duration of treatment. It's amount of exposure that dictates the extent of bone and teeth development, alterations. The way to preclude this is to contraindicate these drugs in children under the age of about 8 to 10. I might also say they're contraindicated in pregnant women. They do cross the placenta, and they clearly can have deleterious effects on the bone formation or bone development in the fetus.
Does that mean it's also contraindicated in lactating mothers?
Yes. Yes, good question. The drug, and again, these vary from drug to drug, and I've tried to stay generic. But the answer is yes, contraindicated in lactating women. There's two other side effects that I want to mention. One is phototoxicity. These drugs all have an affinity for skin and will localize in skin, some more than others. Minocycline preferred, as I indicated, in terms of the treatment of acne. But they have affinity for skin, they localize in skin, and in fair-skinned individuals, they can lead to a phototoxicity, an exaggerated sunburn response, where the individual, if he or she goes out into the sun, will be more sensitive to the sun, may sense a tingling sensation in those areas that are exposed to the sun, and may result in increased tendency to burning. This is most likely the result of the drug binding to skin and absorbing UV light and then emitting, and that emitted light damaging the skin tissue. And so one of the things that you will see with these drugs when they are given by the pharmacist is the caution not to take these drugs and be exposed to sunlight, to use various sunblocks, etc. Now again, if you think about it, it's the teeny boppers, I'm exaggerating, but it's the younger set that is very conscious of color of skin, particularly in the summer, that is also conscious of the quality of the skin that's likely to be taking tetracyclines. And again, these will vary from compound to compound, doxycycline being one of the widely used tetracyclines and also one associated with phototoxicity. And then there's one other characteristic that you see with tetracyclines, but you also see it with other drugs. And this is a good place to introduce it and for you to be aware of it by education, not by experience. Okay? And that is these drugs have the ability in certain women to decrease the effectiveness of oral contraceptives. Not all women, thank goodness. And I might say, not just tetracyclines. This is also associated with ampicillin. Now think back. Ampicillin was the penicillin that had some extended spectrum, but was not completely absorbed. And thus, in going to amoxicillin, you had a much more, you had a form of the drug that was more actively and effectively absorbed. So ampicillin is not completely absorbed, tetracyclines not completely absorbed, and both of these have the ability to diminish the effectiveness of oral contraceptives, and not just in anybody, but there is a subset of women that are more likely to have this result. And these are women that have low circulating levels of estrogen to begin with, and that are on a low estrogen containing oral contraceptive. So if this is the range of estrogen levels, and we know that estrogen levels are highly variable in women, those that are at the greatest risk for breakthrough bleeding and pregnancy are when on an oral contraceptive are those in the bottom portion here with low circulating levels and low estrogen content of the oral contraceptive. So how do these drugs, use ampicillin, tetracyclines, lead to diminished effectiveness of oral contraceptives? And here is the answer. Now, let me just keep it this far, and then we'll worry about it, okay? You know that estrogens circulating in the blood. So here's our patient. Our patient is on an oral contraceptive. Our patient has an oral contraceptive that has low level of estrogen, and she produces a low level. So she's in this bottom quadrant of the range. This estrogen circulates in the blood, and it goes to, and here is, E is simply standing for generic estrogen. The estrogen goes to the liver, and the estrogen gets conjugated. I just put a glucuronic acid on here as an example. So the estrogen circulating in the blood goes to the liver, gets conjugated, and then is passed, the conjugate is passed into the bile. The bile spills into the intestine, and the intestine has bacteria. This is under normal conditions. The intestine has bacteria, beta-glucuronidases, bacterial enzymes that can liberate the conjugate, cleave the glucuronide off, freeing the estrogen that can be reabsorbed. And this is classic enterohepatic circulation. In the presence of tetracyclines and ampicillin, the drug that is not absorbed in the intestine passes into the intestine and inhibits, impairs, knocks off microflora that are responsible for producing the beta-glucuronidase. As a result, less conjugated estrogen in the blood is deconjugated or liberated because there is less beta-glucuronidase being produced by the bacteria in the microflora. Thus, the estrogen level, because of lack of deconjugation and reabsorption, the estrogen level goes from here down to here, and the patient can have First, breakthrough bleeding, and secondly, much increased risk of pregnancy. It is the result of altered microflora leading to diminished reabsorption or diminished liberation of estrogen conjugate that ultimately leads to decrease in the blood level of the estrogen that puts the patient at risk. Yeah?
Isn't there an oral contraceptive that's tetracycline-based?
Boy, I'm not aware of it if it is.
Ortho-tricycline.
I can't even imagine what the logic of that would be. Ortho-tricycline may be an estrogen of some form, okay? But it most likely ain't a tetracycline.
Well, it was okay. Supposed to help with
acne as well as being oral contraceptive. Oh my gosh, this is a magic bullet, right? I can't imagine it. But, it could very well be, okay? It could very well be. If you think about the population at risk, okay? Now, the only reason, minocycline, I don't know what minocycline's effects are on the host microflora. In other words, does minocycline, which is the minocin, or the primary one used for acne, does that put one more at risk or less at risk? I don't know that, okay?
So in practice, would it be beneficial and like cost-effective to test the amount of estrogen in a woman, or do you just let them know that, hey, this can happen?
This can happen, okay? And I know of situations where it has happened, okay? Specifically with ampicillin. I think the patient needs to be advised, okay, that's an excellent question. The patient needs to be advised that the effectiveness of the oral contraceptive may be impaired, and therefore alternate methods of contraception need to be considered. That's one solution. The other solution, without going into measuring estrogen levels, which gets costly, et cetera, is to switch the patient to an oral contraceptive that has a higher estrogen content. But as you know, that's what we're backing away from, because estrogen in oral contraceptives has some risk associated with it. Well, let's take a break here, and then we'll come back and visit another large class of antibiotics called the macrolides. What am I doing here? It locked up on me.